yoga. Sri Krishna is like the sun, and the materialistic speculations about the absolute truth are like, as soon as the Krishna sun is arisen within one's heart, the darkness of material speculations about the absolute truth and the living beings is at once cleared off. In the presence of the sun, the darkness cannot stand, and the relative truths that are hidden within the dense darkness of ignorance become clearly manifest by the mercy of Krishna, who is residing in everyone's heart as the super soul. So, somebody else can read.
In the Bhagavad Gita 10.11, the Lord says that in order to show special favor to His pure devotees, He personally eradicates the dense darkness of all misgivings by switching on the light of pure knowledge within the heart of a devotee. Therefore, because of the personality of Godhead's taking charge of illuminating the heart of His devotee, certainly a devotee engaged in His service and transcendental love cannot remain in darkness. He comes to know everything of the absolute and the relative truths. The devotee cannot remain in darkness, and because the devotee is enlightened by the personality of Godhead, his knowledge is certainly perfect.
This is not the case for those who speculate on the absolute truth by dint of their own limited power of approach. Perfect knowledge is called parampara, or deductive knowledge coming down from the authority to the submissive oral receiver who is bona fide by service and surrender. One cannot challenge the authority of the Supreme and know Him also at the same time. He reserves the right of not being exposed to such a challenging spirit of an insignificant spark of the whole, a spark subjected to the control of illusory energy. The devotees are submissive, and therefore the transcendental knowledge descends from the personality of Godhead to Brahma, and from Brahma to His sons and disciples in succession. This process is held by the Supreme Soul, by the Super Soul within such devotees. That is the perfect way of learning transcendental knowledge.
This enlightenment perfectly enables the devotees to distinguish spirit from matter, because the knot of spirit and the matter is united by the Lord. This knot is called ahankara, and it is falsely obliges a living being to become identified with matter. As soon as this knot is loosened, therefore, all the clouds of doubt are at once cleared off. One sees this master and fully engages himself in the transcendental loving service of the Lord, making a full termination of the chain of fruitive action. In material existence, a living being creates his own chain of fruitive work and enjoys the good and bad effect of those actions life after life. But as soon as he engages himself in the loving service of the Lord, he at once becomes free from the chain of karma. His action no longer creates any reaction.
Thank you. So today I have two statements and then a question for all of you. So I want you to put on your thinking caps. And so I'm going to read you two statements that are about the existential nature of the soul. And then I'm going to ask you a question so we can begin our discussion like that. The first statement comes from Sri Ishupanishad. It's the invocation to Sri Ishupanishad. You may be familiar with the verse. Om Purnam Adat Purnamidam Purnat Purnam Udachate Purnasya Purnam Adaya Purnam Evavashishate. The personality of Godhead is perfect and complete. And because He is completely perfect, all emanations from Him, such as this phenomenal world, are perfectly equipped as complete wholes. Whatever is produced of the complete whole is also complete in itself. Because He is the complete whole, even though so many complete units emanate from Him, He remains the complete balance. So we are living entities, we're the marginal energy of the Lord, so we'd also be covered by this verse as a complete emanation from the Lord. And so what does that mean, complete emanation from the Lord? Well, it certainly applies that whatever we are, whenever we've been it, we've always been that. That makes any sense. It's not that, let's just say the living beings are created at a particular point in time. They're created perfectly at that time and complete at that time. Now, you may say that we're experiencing certain levels of incompletion, or we feel that way in our life in different ways. But that's not because of there's some fault in the Creator. This verse is affirming that at the time when, and again, we speak in terms of creation, but that's kind of a material concept because we know we're eternal. We're not created at any point. But just for sake of our conceptualizing the subject matter, when we are created by the Lord, that creation is complete. Everything that we need, all perfection, is within us at the time of being created like that. So that's the first statement. And the second statement goes to how much, what to what degree that completion, that perfection that we are created with exists. And this verse is from the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's a verse that describes it's in Lord Chaitanya's teachings to Sanatan Goswami. And Lord Chaitanya told him, Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sadhya Kabe Nai Shavanadi Sute Chitti Korya Udoy. Pure love for Krishna is eternally established in the hearts of living entities. It is not something to be gained from another source. When the heart is purified by hearing and chanting, the living entity naturally awakens. So the degree to which we're perfect, as described in that verse of Sri Isha Upanishad, is that Krishna Prema is there. Krishna Prema is there. We are complete beings. Each one of you have the ability to love Krishna fully, completely, with the highest relish of rasa with him. That's the nature of the living being. And he's always been like that. Living beings always like that. From the time of creation, let's just say, again, conceptually. That is the nature of the living being. So these two things together, two statements. Now, here's the question. Why don't we feel love for Krishna? Oh, okay. All right. Why don't we feel love for Krishna?
I think because of the conditioning of soul, and maybe because of our free will. Free will, we want to engage in material attachments, not love for Krishna.
Because we want to enjoy in this material world, that's why we won't be able to love Krishna.
Very good.
Because we've been taking material births for so many lifetimes, we've forgotten our relationship with him.
Anything else? Good, these are good.
Mine is similar to Olivia's. I don't really remember Krishna. So, you know. I mean, in the spiritual world, it's just, Prabhupada describes, you learn about a place, he learned about America by reading about it. So we're learning about Krishna in the spiritual world by reading about it. But I really have no memory of these things. So.
No memory, yes.
I love Krishna, but I also love Maya.
Because we're covered by a veil of ignorance that, you know, forces us to forget about Krishna and who we really are.
Good. This is great. Any more down this way? Should we sagar? Oh, okay. Come on.
Sometimes we really don't want to love Krishna, actually, and rather take shelter of material energy because we are so, we think, oh, it's instant fun.
Can I say something similar in the purport in the verse, a couple of verses before? I think it said that Krishna wants us to go back to Godhead more than we want to go back. So it's like we don't want to. It's like we have, even like for me, we have all the knowledge and we know what we need to do, but it's like
am I really making the effort, you know? Like, do I really want this?
What was your question, like, more specific?
Why don't we feel love for Krishna? If we are complete, perfectly complete, created that way, and that completion includes Krishna prema, then why don't we love Krishna?
Because in our conditional state, we haven't developed an attachment for him.
These are all very good answers. And they... Oh, one more. Okay, Vaishnav.
I believe mostly because we are envious of Krishna. And if you're envious of someone, you can't love him.
Yeah, okay, this is good. Very good. And these things, at least in my mind, they all add up. Everything that everyone said here adds up to ahankar, or the false ego. The false ego is manifest in each of us in all the different ways that you've explained here. So I think that's very good. That's why we don't love Krishna, and that's why it works. Now, how does it work, and how does this ahankara or false ego really feel? How does it feel? Because I think if we understand how it feels, how it works, that's a step towards getting free from it, isn't it? Because in a sense, everyone is subject to this false ego. That's why this whole material world is working. But you all know it, but still we're subject to it. You know, right? You said you love Krishna, but you love Maya also, right? Why would you do that if you actually knew Krishna? That's the point. So how does this false ego, this ahankara work, and how does it feel? Well, I think that there are a couple things we can just say generally, and then we can talk about them specifically. I think it makes us forget our perfection, and that was one of the things that was mentioned here. Right? Who mentioned that? Makes us forget. I think it was down there. Anyway, it makes us forget our perfection. Maya, or the illusory energy, has many different facets or energy. One is the potency to cast a living entity into the material energy, and another is to cover that living entity so that he doesn't remember his original relationship. And ahankara is part of that covering thing. So it makes us forget, but not just that it makes us forget, but it binds us to misidentification. To misidentifying our true self. And then that binding nature, that misidentification expands in different ways. And so those are three general things about how this ahankara works. But what does it feel like? What does it feel like to be subject to a false ego? I'll give you an example to start off, and I'd like to hear from you too. Because this is like a college football town, I'll give a history of my own life from college football. No, I didn't play college football. But I went to college. And I went to college at the United States Military Academy, and we were called Army, and then there's the United States Naval Academy, which was called Navy. And there's a big football rivalry called the Army-Navy game. Right? And so now I went to Army, and we were bombarded from the day we got there with this idea of beating Navy. Beat Navy. That's all we heard. Beat Navy. Beat Navy. Every time we turned around. We were conditioned in that way. We were conditioned to say, your identification is Army, and so therefore your enemy is Navy. And so, therefore, your identification is beat Navy. And they drilled that into our heads. Now, the first year, we indeed did beat Navy. But in the second year, I experienced a feeling I had never experienced before in my life, really. And it was a feeling of not just disappointment, but actually disbelief. When I was at the game, when the game was coming to an end, Army was losing. And I could not believe that was happening. I experienced disbelief for the first time in my life. I don't believe this. This is not real. This cannot be happening. Because we were conditioned to think, beat Navy. That's all we knew. But when Navy was actually beating us, it was so foreign that actually I experienced this disbelief, a feeling of disbelief. That's the influence of ahankar. It can make us feel that way. Does anybody else, I mean, we're all, maybe I shouldn't say we're all conditioned souls, but basically we're struggling. And so does anybody else have any other experience how this type of misidentification of the self with something material resulted in an emotion?
I was thinking of how we feel when either we play a video game or when we watch a movie. So when we play a video game, especially when there are these characters and they're fighting with the enemy and they're, you know, winning over women and all that stuff, when we are actually doing it and we are in that game, when we're fighting with the enemy, we really feel that we're fighting with the enemy. And then when the enemy punches us, we feel like angry towards the enemy and hurt and bad. And when we punch back the enemy, you know, we feel great. And when we get the girl, we feel great. We even feel that our girl is better than any other girl. And that's how we identify with that character. And I was just thinking that that's the same way we identify in our lives with all the roles that we're actually playing.
Okay, that's very good. It has two things. Her comments have two things. One, illustrates how we become identified with a character and we therefore have a whole universe that develops around that. But the interesting point she made is that that's a game and we think it's a game, but it's reality also. The soul is thinking like that about our existence, and it expands further by the soul playing a game and again assuming another body in another universe. So there are different layers that come on to living into to false ego. I think. Yes.
Yeah, it just remind me that very strong identification just growing up in Israel, surrounded by all Arab countries, Muslim countries. And I remember first time I went to, I went to Vrindavan, but one of the time I went to Vrindavan and I met devotees from Iran. And I was totally kind of like blown out that there are, you know, individual people living and have their life and families. And one devotee, actually, she was from Eastern Europe, and she married someone from Iran, and she moved to Iran. And I was like, totally couldn't, you know, grasp that. Why would someone move to live there and, you know, have their life there? And I just realized how strong that identification as being Israeli and, you know, thinking. And totally, like, those countries were just like kind of a, you know, kind of a big impersonal thing for me. Not at all any, you know, place that there are living entities there that, you know, just running their life, you know, normally. As so it was really shocking.
Very good. Identifying yourself as an Israeli, automatically you have enemies or threats. And what really comes, I mean, you didn't express it, but I think probably there's a lot of fear involved with that kind of identification, right? I mean, you identify yourself like that, you see yourself surrounded, and then naturally there's some fear that comes. And that's on an individual level and also on a international level, right? I mean, the protection of Israel has been a big part of this country's also feeling that we have to do that. Because all right, okay.
Carl Jung wrote about these identifications as archetypes, so that people kind of, they fall into a victim mode or the hero mode or...
Okay, very good. Yes, psychologically it affects. It's not, you know, there's different layers, again, of how this affects us. So psychologically that conception is there that I identify myself as a hero type of a personality and therefore I go in a situation and try to do something that's maybe beyond, you know, what I can actually do.
Yes. I'm reading this book written by the Dalai Lama for a class, and he actually says something that struck me and I thought it was really nice. He said that once you start identifying with yourself, then you will start identifying with other people, but based on differences instead of similarities, so that brings like a gap between like the society, I guess, like Surit was saying, like she had her own idea of herself, so then she saw other people as different as her, and then like that creates a lot of conflict too.
Very good. Yes.
Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that the spirit soul influenced by the false ego thinks himself to be the doer of activities which are in actuality carried out by the modes of material nature. And this is something I struggle with because I go about my day and I think I'm doing all these things and I'm completing all these assignments and, you know, I've accomplished these things, but really it's just by Krishna's arrangement that these things are happening.
This is one of the most difficult things to get beyond in our spiritual life, isn't it? I mean, the conception that I'm not the doer. That's really the essence of false ego. It certainly manifests in all the things that everyone has said, but moving beyond this idea that I'm the doer, that's really a tough one. Yeah.
So I was just remembering how in Indian schools there's so much competition within students, and so due to this competition everyone has this image that I can't fail, like, I have to win, like I have to be the best. And most of the times, obviously, there's just one who's the best. So everyone else is kind of much in disbelief. I had experienced this one thing once. Once there was some exam or something, and the Indian students, we really take the exams very seriously. Who's the first, second, third in the class? And that year, there's some student who was not that intelligent, was first. And it seemed as the whole class was in self-denial. How did this guy come first? And totally the false ego was shattered again.
Well, that's the problem. This is a very good point here now. What's the problem with false ego is that it's going to lead us to some kind of disappointment, isn't it? Because we assume certain things are going to happen, are going to come out in a certain way by our ability. They don't, and then we become very, very disappointed, disheartened by it. This is, so I like that emotion there.
Due to misidentification with the body, we also experience pain, pleasure, happiness, distress, hot, cold.
Yes, all kinds of emotions come that, in essence, are sort of false in themselves, aren't they? It's like we're going through life experiencing happiness, distress, being very fearful, or being very proud, or anxious. I've noticed myself that I used to have as my homepage on my computer Google News, and then, you know, every time I opened my computer, there was all these news stories and things like that. Now, due to bodily identification, I identify strongly with Obama as a president. But when I opened my thing, every time I opened it, there was all kinds of like criticism in the political world. There's criticism, and it was too much for me. And I thought, well, you know, I can't take it, you know. So therefore, I had to change my homepage because I wanted to stay away from that kind of identification, you know, and the anxiety that identification caused. That's the point. By identifying a certain way, what we really get, we're looking for pleasure, we're looking for happiness, but what we really get is anxiety, because nothing ever works out the way in which our mind sort of like conjures up that it should. And so all of these are effects of the ahankara of false ego. We're going to talk about how to get out of this, but let's go here.
Go ahead. Yeah, just back to the question of how the false ego makes us feel. I feel like because we've been born in material bodies so many lifetimes, we forget Krishna and our relationship with him. But also it seems like being in the material body and being covered by the false ego, also it gives us a sense of feeling trapped and like a little bit like uncomfortable, like something is missing and or like this just isn't quite right.
I had a question. I feel like it's so wonderful that when we're in conversations with devotees, the false ego, like in my case, sometimes almost immediately, I can hear myself speaking through my false ego. Like I'll express some sort of pride or anger or something like that, and then because that's being sort of reflected off of the devotee that I'm speaking with, immediately I feel like embarrassed. Oh my gosh, my false ego is so huge. So I'm wondering, what is that? Where is that feeling of embarrassment coming from? Is that also the false ego, or is that actually our? Is that coming from a more pure place?
Well, embarrassing is one of the things I had on my list, one of the emotions that I wanted to talk about as being a result of false ego. So yeah, but it may come from different places depending on who's feeling that. You as a devotee of the Lord are feeling that at some kind of realization. You know, and Olivia's statement also gets to some kind of a realization that devotees have about how we're trapped, how we're being illusioned, how we're being made a fool of by the false ego. Others don't know. They are experiencing the same thing, but they don't know that I'm a spirit soul trapped in there. And so your feeling like that may come from because you're a devotee of the Lord. But it may also, an ordinary person, it may also be embarrassing. The false ego is kind of an embarrassing kind of situation. Any embarrassment, if you look at some situation where a person's really embarrassed, it probably has to do with some exhibition of their false ego and that being denied in one way or another. So yeah. So now that you sort of started us on this track, well, we know, and we've had some good comments here about how we're entrapped by false ego. How do we get out of false ego? That's the point. Anybody have some ideas on how do we get out of the false ego? Okay, on the table.
I think by associating with senior devotees, because they'll tell you you're in Maya. That's good.
Okay, being told we're in Maya. It depends on how big your false ego is. You might think, well, no, I'm not, you know. And then you wouldn't be able to take advantage of that instruction. But yes, associating with devotees. I had an experience also on a library party. We broke up every week into teams of two people, and we drove off, and we spent a week with one other devotee going some places. And I happened to be with Mahadyuti Prabhu, a good friend of ours, and I think they stuck me with him because I was newest on the party. Because he was a little hard to be with for a week at a time. But it helped my false ego. Helped my false ego some, so that's good. But yeah, okay, how do we get out? Association with devotees, yes.
By praying the spirits of Master and Krishna to help us release us from this false ego so we can make advancement.
Praying to the spiritual master and Krishna. That's very good. Yeah.
While chanting japa, we can try to forget about the false ego and focus just on the names. Try as hard as we can to focus on just the forms and sound of the name.
By focusing on chanting Hare Krishna, focusing on the name. Very good. Okay,
just reading more Prabhupada's books and reading about him and the other acharyas to give a perspective of how stupid our ego is.
Right, by knowledge. If we don't have knowledge that of the hankara, then we're never going to be able to go anywhere.
Yeah, I believe first step is recognizing which one are the many false egos that you have and working one by one by one. I mean, recognizing them and then working on them.
Good. I like that, Baldev, because it leads to an example that I wanted to give. Now, because he said working on the many levels of false ego we have. False ego is like layers. It has so many layers that we're subject to. And this was described by a sort of a children's movie character in a famous movie several years ago. Is anybody familiar with the movie Shrek?
Yes.
Shrek, okay. Now, Shrek spoke philosophy in his movie. He did. He was with this donkey, and the donkey was trying to be his friend. But he told him why he didn't want to be his friend. And he said that ogres are like onions. You remember this? He said ogres are like onions. And what do onions have? Layers, right? They have layers, just like Baladev told us, you know. Onions, we have layers of false ego on us, and they're just like what Shrek was talking about, the layers of an onion. they cover us one time after another, 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 and all these layers are bound together by this ahankara, false ego. And Shrek's problem was is that he didn't know how to have a relationship, how to have a friendship or anything like that. And he admitted it is because we're covered by layers. We're all kind of ogres ourselves, actually. If we think about, if we were plopped down in the spiritual world, we'd be like an ogre being plopped down there, wouldn't we? Because we're covered by so many layers of false ego, we don't know how to act. We don't know how to act with the devotees. We don't know how to act with the spiritual master. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur had a very erudite scholar come to him one time, and he wanted to become his disciple. And so what did he tell him to do? Does anybody know the story? What did he tell him to do? What did he tell him? Wash the pots is similar. Clean the latrines is similar. He told him to go work in the Goshala. You know, go work in the Goshala. And he thought, what? You know, I'm a big scholar. Why are you asking me to go work in the Goshala? And he left. He couldn't take it. You know, he couldn't take that test of his false ego because he was covered by so many layers. So, yeah. We have to hear from the spiritual master. That will help us clear these things from the heart, because these things are in the heart. This is where the covering of ahankara lies. And so we have to hear. There's a story of Hanuman. Hanuman, you know, that when he was a child, he was kind of a naughty kind of monkey. And he was causing trouble to sages when they were meditating and trouble in the village, everything. And so he was, there were many things that happened, but essentially he was cursed that he would forget his powers, all the powers he had. And he didn't remember them until someone reminded him. Someone spoke to him about his powers. Therefore, they became revived. And all those powers, even Krishna Prema, Nityasiddha Krishna Prema, Sadhya Kabai Nai, that Krishna Prema that's within our heart, that's covered by all these layers of false ego. And Shavanadi Shuddha Chitti Koriya Udoy. By hearing, it says, when the heart is purified by hearing and chanting, the living entity naturally awakens. And so this hearing process is the way that we start to become free from false ego. We hear the instructions about false ego itself in Bhagavad Gita. Then we hear about Krishna and his pastimes. We hear about our own glorious being, that we are spirit souls and that we do have Krishna Prema within our heart. We hear about our potential. And simply by this process of hearing, we start to develop, we start to come out of this illusion of the false ego and to understand who we actually are. And this is described in a couple of verses in Bhagavad Gita. Actually, do you know the four nutshell verses of Bhagavad Gita? Chatur Shloka Bhagavad Gita? Can anybody... They're in chapter 10. Let me read them to you. I have them here. Let's see. Okay, chapter 10, starting with text number 9. The thoughts of my pure devotees dwell in me. Their lives are fully devoted to my service, and they derive great satisfaction and bliss from always enlightening one another and conversing about me. So, actually the first one is... 8 is the first one. I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. The wise who know this perfectly engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their hearts. And then number 10 and number 11 describe actually the process of how false ego is dispelled. And so this subject matter is so important that these are the four chati sloki of Bhagavad Gita, the four main verses, the seed verses of Bhagavad Gita, and they deal with this subject matter of how hearing frees us from false ego and allows us to engage in devotional service. Krishna says, the thoughts of my pure devotees dwell in me, their lives are fully dedicated to my service, and they derive great satisfaction and bliss from always enlightening one another and conversing about me. To those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give the understanding by which they can come to me. To show them special mercy, I, dwelling in their hearts, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. So these verses describe the process of how false ego is dispelled. It's actually just an illusion, although it appears to us to be, as described in today's verse, a very hard knot. A very hard knot, difficult to untie. You can't untie it. But it's untied by simply the process of hearing. Hearing. It seems rather simple for such a complicated thing. But that's what it is. And so that's how we can become free, is by hearing. And that's how Hanuman actually regained his powers, by hearing. So does anybody have any questions about all this? You have a point back there? No? Okay. Yes.
So earlier when we were talking about false ego and what false ego does, basically we think I, me and mine. And then we come to devotional service. And my question is there, does the real ego allow us to think me and them, so to speak? In other words, we come to Krishna consciousness and we think we devotees and other non-devotees. Or you see that kind of differentiation even in the spiritual world in that sense, one group and another group. So does the real ego allow such things? Because certainly we're not impersonal. It's not all one. There is differences. So how do we understand the real ego and the false ego and what it accommodates?
Very good question, because we're talking about ahankara. There is ahankara. There is real ego. There is real ego. And so how is that real ego manifests? Well, I think that it's going to start in degrees. Black, white, crossing lines, and that's really not how spiritual life kind of works. And so as we become cleared from false ego, then we go towards real ego, never stopping at impersonalism, by the way. And so I like your point, because you're saying that there is real ego, there's a real person. But as we're on the path, then we may fall into we devotees versus them, the non-devotees. Sort of was saying about the Israelis and others. We may think, well, we're the devotees. Other spiritualists are like this. Other religions are like this. What to speak of the complete materialists who have no conception of God. How do we think about them? Does anybody have some suggestions to help Madhumati out here? Yes.
Mataji said, if we're in the someone from the vantage point of the spiritual world, are there such divisions? How would you see such jivas in the material world, right? Is that what you were asking? Because I suppose that if we're in the spiritual world, if we're back in the spiritual world serving Krishna, then we would see the material world, I suppose, with sadness and compassion, because we see all these jivas who have left the association of Krishna and his pure devotees in Vaikuntha. So we would, I assume, want to help them from the spiritual world. I don't know.
I try to treat everyone really nicely, because even people that are not Hare Krishnas, I don't know, I just see so much benefit. The other day, I just brought this up. I met this Jehovah's Witness. I think Jehovah's Witnesses love me. I don't know what it is, but they find me wherever I am. And yes, 2 days ago they came to my door, and it was an older man who was like maybe in his 70s, and a girl who was like 18, and they were preaching to me, and I was sharing our philosophy with them. And then he asked, the first thing he asked me was if I was a Hare Krishna, because I had tilak on. And he told me that he had been to the temple in 1973 here in Gainesville, a couple of blocks down the street, downtown. And I think, and we left, I took one of his books, I gave him a little donation for them, and he felt, I think he had a good impression of the Hare Krishnas. I mean, he already had one, but now it's like even better. And then this girl that was like 18 was so astonished that I had taken a book. And so I try to see everyone that's making an effort to know God, I try to treat them nicely and not just like destroy their philosophy. You know?
Okay, two good things that we see equally and that we see with compassion. I think that those are signs of being free from ahankara, that we're compassionate to everyone, not just our own kind.
I was just thinking in terms of it's like the Uttamadhikari that he sees equally as the spirit soul and in connection to Krishna, and also in the spiritual world, everybody, there is the discrimination, but everybody sees everybody else in relationship to Krishna. So it's kind of like the real ego does discriminate, but it doesn't act on this discrimination for their own satisfaction, kind of like on sense gratification. But when we are under the false ego, we discriminate, but then we act on it also. We discriminate, but we don't see that connection with Krishna, then we kind of act on it to our own sense enjoyment and whatever and things. So that's kind of a... I also heard a story about Prabhupada like that, that he was in one conversation with some Indian gentleman in India. He was challenging that he's like, how is it? He's not like equally. It's like that's a Samadarshanaha, I think that's from that verse. And so he was saying, well, I'm not on that level. And also, otherwise, how would you understand if someone come as a dog and someone come as a brahmana? You understand this karma. And I can't remember the all details, but later on, someone else came to the room and he was telling about Prabhupada. He was telling to that gentleman that Prabhupada have devotees. He made devotees from all over the world, from Western countries. And then Prabhupada said, yes, that's my Samadarshanaha. Kind of a...
Yeah, that's very good. Oh, okay.
Sort of similar, but I was driving to Santa Fe with Akuti Prabhu when I was at Bhakti Bhavan. We were going to go to the Krishna lunch there. And on the way there, I just asked her, I was looking around and I was seeing all the people driving next to us and they were smoking or, you know, listening to their music really loud and stuff. And I was just thinking, wow, everyone is suffering so much and they don't even know it. And like, so miserable, this condition of life. And I asked her, I didn't say anything. I just said, what do you think when you look around at everybody in this world? And she said, I just think how they're all spirit souls, like part and parcel of Krishna, you know? And I was like, wow, that's such a positive way of, because she doesn't, like you're saying that the discrimination for sense gratification wasn't there, like it is for me. It was such a positive statement, you know, how that's why she wants to go out, is because she knows everyone's connected to Krishna. She just wants to help them remember, you know, really far out.
Very good. Yep, go, Paul.
I heard a lecture by Prabhupada, and he was saying, you know, like we've all heard, hate the sin, not the sinner. And he said, if you hate the sinner, then you can't elevate him. Not only that, he's sinning because he's crazy, and so in that sense, he's innocent.
So I think these are good answers to your question. You satisfied?
This is kind of similar to what Gopal Prabhu just said, how you should hate the sin and not the sinner. I feel my personal experience, I have the problem of always hating the sinner, like within myself, rather than the sin. Like, I think one thing that prevents us from shedding our false ego is not accepting that our constitutional position is to be a servant of Krishna. I know for myself, like, I'm slowly realizing that I'm not this body, but accepting that I'm a servant of Krishna is hard to do when you see
all these bad qualities and all these sinful desires that you have, it's like there's no way that I could be a devotee of Krishna. So.
Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sadhya Kabinai Shavanadi Shute Chitti Korea Udoy. We all have the potency within us to be completely pure lovers of Krishna. That is who we really are. All the rest of it is just illusion. And I'm going to get to you here. Let me just mention one point, because when she asked her question, the responses were how a person free from false ego sees this material world. But if that person turns around, completely purified person, and sees the spiritual world, what do they see there? In the spiritual world, there is distinction made. We're part of Radharani's camp. We're not part of Chandravali's camp. You know, even our acharyas, some of them say that, you know, they don't want to have anything to do with Chandravali's camp or any of them. You know, this is we're here, they're there. You know, so this type of identification that's based on real ego and not the false ego for sense gratification does exist in the spiritual world. Similarly, we identify very strongly with our service. We have, each of us, along with our love for Krishna, that love for Krishna is not something that's just abstract. It's concrete in terms of how it's expressed in a service. And so we're very much attached to and identifying with that service in terms of our real ego in the spiritual world. So there is real ego there. And it begins here, loyalty to the spiritual master as well, fidelity to the spiritual master. That's part of our real identification. That's our eternal relationship. So there is ego in the spiritual world as persons, but it's real ego. Let me go back here and then come back to you.
Paul kind of addresses this in Romans. He talks about now we're seeing through like a glass half full, but that when we pass out of this world, we'll know fully as we're fully known. So that the kind of the false ego will drop away, and we'll see things clearly, and we'll know ourselves, our true identity.
Okay, yeah, that's perfect. So, in other religious traditions, the same teaching is there. Thank you for that.
I was remembering we were talking about the spiritual world, about Radharani's camp and Chandravali's camp. I was listening to a tape by Radha Govinda Maharaj, and he was talking about the two camps and what point that Clayton was mentioning about compassion. So he was saying that how actually that one time when Krishna left Radharani, the response of the other camp was also feeling compassion, feeling sad for Radharani that she, you know, that Krishna had left her. So making the point you were saying is that although there is distinction, but it's free from the false ego. The reaction was one of compassion. Then, these are our enemies, and so good. You know, it wasn't so.
Okay, let's go here for one last comment to our director.
This is a side comment or question. I wanted to know if there's any Vaishnavas on the planet who are actually aspiring to be in the opposite camp.
I don't know that I can answer that question, so I won't try. But that's an interesting question. Save it for someone more advanced than myself.
Can you explain what Chandravali is?
Chandravali is Radharani's rival. And it's part of the sweetness of the relationship between Radha and Krishna, that she have a rival, so that it evokes her love for Krishna more. And so it's there. Described. Okay. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.